You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, the ceasefire in Syria is in trouble as rebel groups announce they are halting preparations for peace talks later this month. In the US, Republicans have given up their plan to weaken the body that investigates claims of misconduct against members of Congress after a bit of hullabaloo. My guests, Mary Jodevsky and James Boyes, will also discuss some less common diplomatic practices, including the latest tweets from President-elect Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin's unexpectedly conciliatory response to the expulsion of Russian diplomats by the US. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Jodevsky, a columnist for The Independent and The Guardian newspapers, and James Boyes, Associate Professor of International Relations at Richmond University. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start in Syria, where rebel groups have announced that they are suspending participation in peace talks planned for later this month. According to the rebels, violations of the ceasefire by the Syrian government had prompted them to reconsider their involvement. The ceasefire deal was brokered by Turkey and Russia last Thursday and has mostly held since then. James, there's lots of manoeuvring going on here. Is this the end of this ceasefire, or is this just them holding out for, you know, putting an end to this final bit of skirmishing that seems to be going on around Damascus?
Well, it's perhaps a little early to tell, but let's be honest about this. This is a war with no heroes and only casualties, quite frankly. And what I think you're seeing is, you know, a power play being played out in a power vacuum. You know, we're waiting for the change of government to come in Washington, D.C. Clearly, Putin and Assad are, you know, in the ascendancy. I think that if you were, you know, the rebels at this point, you'd be looking around and thinking, well, you know, where is any support? And likewise, if you were Assad's forces, you'd be thinking, well, this is the time now to push on and finish a job effectively. It's a short window of opportunity, I think, that the Assad regime have to basically quash this. Nobody knows, quite frankly, what it is that President Trump is going to do when he takes power at the end of this month. But certainly, I think at this point, it looks particularly bleak for the rebels at this point. And I appreciate that's British understatement coming through.
We know there are many different rebel groups, and in some areas there does seem to be a cessation of fighting. But here we're talking about a particular incident around Damascus where it seems that Assad's forces have continued to fight against rebel groups in strategic areas. Now, what do we think that says about the bigger peace deal, just before I bring in Mary? Because it would hint that perhaps the Assad regime is not doing what the Turks and the Russians want as well.
Yeah, true. I mean, I think from Assad's point of view, you know, and not trying to side or explain the devil, but it's a question of national interest. I mean, ultimately, you've got to defend the capital. Damascus obviously needs to be held. And clearly, there's been a massive push with regard to other parts of the country at this point of town, a place like Aleppo, for example. But if there's any sign of weakness around Damascus, then that's something which Assad really needs to basically quash. And at this point, I think that when you consider the fact that there's no clear direction of policy coming out of Washington, it's in his national interest to do that, irrespective of what we might think of that and what we might say from the international community's point of view.
Mary, we're talking here about a power vacuum caused by Washington, D.C., you know, still having reverberations. Because we'd imagine that somehow the failure of Obama to really intervene or to control this event in any way, shape or form had given the, you know, the room over to the Russians and now the Turks to kind of make a deal that looked like it was going to stick. Do you think that's right, that in the end, it needs to have the Americans involved and their backing to really bring peace in the country?
I'm not sure about that. I think the problem at the moment is the uncertainty, as you said and James said, the vacuum that's there, because it still gives hope to those rebels who'd banked on having Western support, that that support might still be forthcoming after the change of power in Washington. Now, I mean, I think that's extremely unlikely because Donald Trump already said a long time time ago that he was very against US intervening in foreign wars and this war in particular. So I think that they're really on a hiding to nothing there. But what we're looking at is almost a sort of mirror image of what we were looking at before. I mean, it's, you know, it's so interesting that you were looking before at a situation where, as it were, these were our rebels, and they were the sort of injured party, and they were fighting heroically the right cause. And now the coverage is so much the other way, because the victory for Assad and his allies and his forces now looks so absolutely certain, really.
But do you think that, you know, despite the certainty of that, you know, the rebel groups are obviously very cautious about committing to this process. Do you think that actually this might not stick as a peace deal? Because we've seen many attempts before, and while it may immediately have looked like a kind of a victory for the Russians and their bombing campaign, it still doesn't look really clear that it's going to has any path to really lead to a sustainable peace, does it, Mary?
No, I mean, I think that after the fall of Eastern Aleppo, it was generally said that even though that might give rise to the consolidation of something like a victory for Assad, it would not be a complete victory, and it wouldn't be right across the country. And I think, you know, if you're looking at now, and you're looking at, say, 3-4 years ago, then the actual territory that President Assad can control is quite considerably less than it was before, because you're looking at Kurdish areas, you're looking at the way Islamic State has sort of come in and sort of gone back, but, you know, so far as I know, they still control Palmyra. So there are going to be Assad's power territorially is going to be vastly more circumscribed than it was 4 years ago.
And James, just tell me, this power vacuum that we talk about, and, you know, and Mr. Trump, you know, we talked about him saying he doesn't want to fight other people's wars, you know, he doesn't think that they should intervene. But he's also talked about, you know, hitting ISIS, and hitting ISIS hard is in two places. It's in Syria and Iraq with proper bases. That's where it's anchored. How possible is it for him to walk away from those two arenas and say, look, we'll have nothing to do with it, and come good on his belief that, you know, the American government should wipe ISIS off the map?
I think it's impossible. I mean, he's basically, you know, I stand here as someone who couldn't believe that it was possible for him to be elected for a whole variety of reasons, not least of which was the fact that he kept painting himself into these corners which were indefensible, and, you know, you couldn't possibly get out of with a clean face, effectively. And he's now put himself in two different positions. You know, the problem with Syria was always, quite frankly, there was no unified perspective about who the opposition was. You know, it were different, disparate groups. And from a Washington point of view, it would seem to have backed, you know, individual groups before, and end up with a blowback situation. You know, anybody who watched Charlize Wilson's War, for example, will know exactly what that's all about. Where you've got Donald Trump now, I think, is that, you know, this is someone, the first American president who's never held political office before, never served in the military before, talking his way blindly into a situation, talking about knowing more than the generals. I think he can, frankly, believes he can just bomb the hell out of these people. And he's basically said as much in his, you know, more graphic detail than that, not to have to put ground troops in and obliterate these people. Well, the Americans are doing that to a certain extent, and it's not worked so far. So quite what Donald Trump, you know, this, you know, military mastermind thinks he's going to bring to this is anybody's guess at this point. And that's the problem, is nobody knows.
And also, Mary, if he does take on the kind of, you know, that kind of Russian style of bombing campaign, that won't play well at home. In the end, people don't like seeing innocent civilians killed, you know, as collateral damage.
I think it's extremely unlikely that that's what he would actually choose to do. I mean, you know, we've all been so wrong about Trump in the past that it's entirely possible that judgment's wrong as well. But my view is that on the basis of what Trump has said, that he wants America to draw in its horns. He doesn't want interventions, and I suspect that he also doesn't, you know, for all his own sort of gung-ho profile and character, I suspect he doesn't want to get Americans implicated in that so far away from their own borders.
We're going to stick with Mr. Trump and a story that has twisted and turned all day. Because in the US, Republicans in the House of Representatives have decided to drop a plan to gut the independent body that investigates political misconduct after an outcry. Democrats reacted with outrage to the vote that was supposed to be passed in the first session of the new Congress. President-elect Donald Trump also criticized Republicans over the vote. James, what a day. Now, if this is any hint of what, you know, dominant Republican power is going to look like, it doesn't actually play out in the way that you would imagine. It doesn't bring cohesive government. It looks chaotic.
I think what it does do, which actually is quite helpful, is it dispels the myth and the misunderstanding which I think often prevails in this country that just because you have a president and a Congress of the same party means that they are going to be walking lockstep together just as though you would here in the Great Britain with obviously the executive and the legislature being controlled by the same party.
And that's actually you could add to that saying with this president and this Republican Party that even more so.
True. But irrespective of who the president is, we've seen examples in the past where we've had Democrats controlling all the three main areas of government, and it's not worked out. What we've seen here is also very interesting, which is it has demonstrated once and again the fact that the leadership of the Republican Party, you've got a major problem on their hands, because this move to gut the Office of Congressional Ethics was not led by the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy. It was led by rank-and-file Republicans acting against the advice of the leadership. And it's fascinating that Donald Trump, it was him that came in and basically, through tweets of all things, openly criticised this. I mean, it's just, we're walking into the realms of the ridiculous almost, but the fact that it has worked is remarkable, that he has shamed these people effectively into reversing this course of action. Dare I say it, is it something positive that Donald Trump has actually done before he's even taken office, potentially?
Well,
Mary, you seem
I think
prize.
I mean it's so interesting that James said in just a few minutes ago that that Trump, as we know, is the first president not to have political experience. He's the first president not to have served in the military or to have had political experience. And the interesting thing is that this particular decision, the way he's moved on this particular decision, suggests that he's not a bad politician after all. Because this is sensing, in a way, where public opinion in America would surely be. The idea that Republican rank and file, against the views of their leadership, would want to defang a particular ethics committee for members of Congress. Ordinary Americans would generally be horrified about that. And if Trump senses that immediately and gets them to overturn the decision, I agree. Maybe this is one of the first positive decisions taken by Trump almost before he's taken office.
Well, it went against his idea of this catchphrase of draining the swamp, of getting rid of corruption at the centre of government, which he said he would move against. But why did these Republicans instinctively feel, Mary, actually that it was the right thing to do?
Well, this is a most extraordinary thing because you really wouldn't have thought. These guys are mostly professional politicians. They might have had half an idea. Now, maybe if you want to be sort of super Machiavellian about it, what they were trying to do was to curry favour with the new president against the leadership of their party in Congress. But if that's what they were about, I mean, they miscalculated disastrously.
James, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is, there's been an awful lot of people over the last 6 to 12 months who've compared Donald Trump with Ronald Reagan, which I always thought was a mistake for a whole variety of reasons, not least of which was the fact that Ronald Reagan had been at least governor of California. I think an interesting parallel here, both in terms of where he's from, his demeanour, how he's using publicity and this publicist approach, and his willingness to break from the rank and file of the leadership, is actually with Teddy Roosevelt. He was someone who I think would have acted in very, very similar stances if he were alive and tweeting today, quite frankly. And the idea that Trump here is willing to stand up, actually, interestingly enough, alongside Speaker Ryan, who, of course, was someone who he had a massive falling out with during the campaign, I think speaks very, very interestingly to how the White House under Trump and the congressional leadership under the Republican Party could walk hand in hand together, which is certainly something which hasn't happened over the last 8 years.
And as you say, I think what was interesting was it seemed that it was him that had the first guess that publicly this would play badly. This would play badly with his constituency. Because there were many advisers around him who were still going on TV all day kind of justifying the move, saying it was, you know, not the greatest committee and it was an unfair committee and it had done things wrong in the past, trying to justify the decision.
Yeah, it's important to recognise, I think, to be fair, that the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, was also saying that this was a mistake and it was done against his advice and the leadership. This was something which was basically a root and file grassroots movement defying the leadership. So the idea, again, that it's pushed the leadership of the House under Ryan and Trump together, I think, is going to be interesting to see how that manifests itself moving forward, and also the extent to which the White House and the leadership can keep the sort of rank and file Republicans, you know, what we used to refer to quite, you know, all the time as the Tea Party movement, effectively in check, because of course they've been, you know, very, very difficult for the Republican leadership to keep in file, which is the main reason that John Boehner is no longer the Speaker of the House, of course.
And Mary, just, you know, for, you know, our listeners, I guess we fall into a trap here in Europe of thinking that, you know, this is like party politics we see here in Europe, that people act together, are unified, that they will stand behind their new leader. But we here see many personal interests being played out. You know, you see interests of, you know, state by state playing out. We shouldn't expect really, you know, the Congress or even the Senate to kind of line up and just do what Trump wants over the next 4 years.
No, I think that's true. I mean, there are enormous sectional interests and, you know, every member of Congress will have all his personal causes and the support and the funding that he has to look for. But I do think that it's very, very interesting that already Trump appears to be starting to manage Congress in this sort of trader's way that was sort of foreshadowed during his campaign. And it's something that President Obama was just so bad at. President Clinton, Bill Clinton, in his time, was much better. He learnt how to do it. George Bush started marginally better at it, and he sort of succeeded passably at managing Congress. Trump could actually show how it's done.
Do you feel that same confidence, James?
Well, it's delightful to hear someone else talk about how poor Obama's working relationship with Congress, because for so long it's always been, oh, it was Republicans objecting to Obama. It's also important to remember, of course, that Congress is not there to rubber stamp whatever a president wants, whoever the president might be. So absolutely, you know, we are moving into a really new, interesting age. It's not an age that many of us would necessarily have welcomed or expected, but hey, you know what? It's going to be interesting.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Mary Jezeski and James Boyes. Coming up next, what separates responsible from irresponsible diplomacy? Stay tuned.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and still with me, Mary Jezeski and James Boyes. President-elect Donald Trump has dismissed North Korea's claim to be developing missiles capable of striking America. Trump said on Twitter, "It won't happen," in response to North Korea's Kim Jong-un's announcement that preparations were in their final stages. This is certainly something very different compared to the usual Western reactions to North Korean announcements. Mary, first of all, we're wondering what he actually meant by it won't happen. Does he mean the tests won't happen? They won't hit America, won't happen? But what a way to do foreign policy.
Well, yes, and I mean, we're all sitting here at least smiling, if not actually laughing.
In horror.
In horror, but also, you know, the sheer sort of direct response to somebody like Kim Jong-un, who is appears himself so irresponsible and so heedless of what anybody else seems to think. And it's tempting to say almost the pair of them have met their match and that maybe this is how to treat the North Korean leader. The trouble is that in the past, Kim has shown himself to be very, very prickly and also quite quick, as it appears, almost to panic. And there was a case quite early in Obama's presidency where Kim Jong-un was giving all sorts of threats and threatening nuclear tests and goodness knows what else. And it appears that President Obama asked, well, you know, is there a reason why he's doing this? And the reason turned out to be that, in fact, there were joint US-South Korean maneuvers that were just skirting the edge of North Korean airspace and looking, if you were sitting in Pyongyang, extremely threatening. And what President Obama did was basically to call off, not exactly to call off the whole exercises, but to say that they shouldn't fly so close so that they looked so much of a direct threat to North Korea. So I think we, you know, on the one hand, it's entertaining to see this sort of bombastic response and you think, well, that's exactly what Kim Jong-un deserves. But there's a dangerous aspect to this because if you scare him, then you may get more than you bargained for.
James, one of the interesting things is, you know, we know what Trump thinks of China, that America has given over jobs and money and power to China and got almost nothing in return. And one of the good points he made, actually, I think, pre-Christmas, he was like, look, for ages we've been negotiating with the Chinese over North Korea. They have influence and power there. They could actually do something about this, and they don't do anything. So this is his way of also tweaking the tale of China again, isn't it? Saying, look, you know, you keep on claiming that you've got sanctions in place. Your trade has never been greater with North Korea. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, I mean, it takes something, doesn't it? In the matter of what, 280 characters to take on the combined might, wealth and population of North Korea and China. And yet that's exactly what Donald Trump has done and is doing. You know, Mary's point is really well made. You know, the idea that you need to look at this from the other side, the idea that war game a couple of years ago caused Kim to react as he did. You know, we had a similar situation during the Cold War with Operation Able Archer when the Russians really thought that NATO was on the verge of a first strike operation. Now we have Donald Trump who has taken to Twitter to try and talk about, you know, this isn't going to happen. Well, how do we know that? Because what we do know about Donald Trump is he's not getting his intelligence briefing. You know, so, you know, if it was like, I've been briefed by my national security advisor and I can tell you this isn't going to happen, that would be one thing. But we know that he's not getting this intel brief that every other president-elect rushes to because it's kind of like, you know, oh my goodness, I'm getting all the state secrets now. And Trump's attitude is, well, nothing's happened today. I don't need to know about it. How we can talk about this isn't going to happen, or you know, make some underhand reference to perhaps preventing it from happening, because you know, as we learnt during the Korean War, you know, the only thing that we can guarantee is that the Chinese do not want a unified, you know, Korea on the Korean Peninsula with American influence extending right up to the Chinese border.
But they do claim they want a denuclearized peninsula, and they don't seem to do a huge amount about it. So again, I just come back to that phone.
Yeah, well, I would suggest to you that they would much rather prefer the status quo at the moment with a nuclear North Korea, I think, than a unified Korea under an American security umbrella. That, I think, is far more dangerous and troubling to China than the current situation.
Mary, the Washington Post today says that this manoeuvring by Trump has shown him to look a bit kind of stupid and, you know, not very professional, and has landed a diplomatic coup, you know, without any effort into the lap of the Chinese, who look like statesmanlike, considered, conciliatory, you know, planning ahead. Do you think that that's true, that the Chinese do begin to look, you know, rather good just because of Donald Trump's rather kind of hasty, you know, turning to Twitter?
Well, in a way they do, simply because they look calmer and more measured and they look as though they're sort of looking ahead in a more judicious way. But I think that the Trump China relationship will be, you know, given that this is going to be such an extraordinarily interesting period, I think the Trump-China relationship could be one of the most interesting aspects of it. Because China really has had quite an easy ride from the United States, although that, you know, Congress, in fact, has given it a much harder time with various very hard-hitting reports about its China's ambitions and its military capabilities. At the sort of presidential level, it's actually been treated with a degree of general respect and left alone. And China has also behaved in quite a sort of, it's been very canny about the way it's handled what's called, what's generally termed, you know, China's rise. So it will be very interesting to watch to see whether Donald Trump is actually as incautious as he appears with every other country, also towards China, which is rapidly becoming the main competitor on the world stage to the US.
Well, I'm sure the neighbours in South Korea and Japan will also be slightly concerned about...
And Taiwan.
Yes. Now, finally today, Vladimir Putin said he wouldn't stoop to irresponsible diplomacy when he found out that Barack Obama was sending some Russian diplomats back to Moscow. He's received a lot of attention for his decision not to expel US diplomats from Russia. Mary, how do you understand Putin's approach to this row? Why do you think he's decided to take this tack?
Well, as we're sort of confessing mistakes, I will say that I got this absolutely totally wrong, because I thought that Russia would have no alternative but tit-for-tat, one-on-one expulsions, just to show that it is strong, to position itself in advance of the Trump presidency. What I think happened is, you know, in Trump's words, much smarter. But I also think it illustrates to an extent a certain weakness on Putin's side. Not that he took that decision. That was a very clever decision to take diplomatically. But I think it shows how very desperate Russia is to improve relations with the United States, and how much it's looking forward to the possibility of doing that with Donald Trump. And of course, by staking so much on a change in that relationship, I think if it goes wrong, even slightly, then that's going to be a huge loss for Moscow.
Do you think he's just going to, Mr. Trump's just going to say to the Russians, bring them all back again as soon as he comes into power?
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. I think you can make a link here between what Putin has done in this case and what Theresa May has done with regard to the British reaction to John Kerry's speech with regard to Israel, in as much as, you know, neither Putin nor May are looking backwards to, well, you know, we've got to stay friends with Barack Obama. They're being realist, and they're recognising that Obama is leaving. You know, the new sheriff is arriving in town on January 20th. He is going to be the new president, and it's with him that Russia and Great Britain are going to need to deal. And so I think that both with regard to British policy, with regard to the Middle East, and with regard to Putin and his move here, what's the point? We're going to withdraw these diplomats, what, for 15 days and then reposition them? I think it's almost like a final slap to Barack Obama's legacy, quite frankly, and suggesting, well, actually your move is irrelevant. The new team is about to arrive, and we'll just wait and deal with them.
But do you think, James, that tit-for-tat thing that we normally see in these diplomatic, you know, spats, what's clever about this is just a very different way of dealing with those situations. And is that unusual? Because normally it is very much tit-for-tat, isn't it?
Well, Mary's absolutely right. I mean, you know, forecasting that line of approach is based upon decades of experience. You know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that analysis at all. It's what most people would have expected. But I think when you look at the timescales involved here, and also look at what a relatively meagre reaction and series of expulsions the Obama team put in place, considering how strong the allegations were against what the Russians had done, it did seem a rather weak approach, I thought, from the Obama White House. And so for Putin, I think, to turn around and say, you know what, this is irrelevant and so are you, is a really interesting approach to take.
Well, thank you very much, James Boyes and Mary Jezewski, for joining us today on Midori House, because that's all we have time for on the show today. The programme was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Yulene Goffin and Helena Jarrett. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next. Then at 1900 hours London time, it's our dedicated design programme, Section D. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is going to be back at the very same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.